Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Kanan Makia joins us now. He is a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at Brandeis University. The Baghdad-born intellectual is probably best known as the key moral voice who pushed for the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. At the time, he was an unofficial spokesman for the Iraqi community in exile. He met with members of the Pentagon, State Department, and President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney in the run-up to the war. He also contributed governance plans to the State Department's 2003 Future of Iraq project. Iraq today, of course, is in chaos. Makia's previous books, Republic of Fear and Cruelty and Silence, were deeply influential texts before the war. But after the war, he didn't release another major book, as he, in the words of the New York Times, struggled to, quote, make sense of his own role in the catastrophe. Well, this spring, Kanan Makia published his latest book, a novel. It's called The Rope. And Kanan Makia joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's good to have you. I mean, let me start with a little bit more about what the New York Times wrote about in a review of your book. They called the book, the new novel, The Rope, that it represents a decade of introspection for a man whose life's work was closely associated with a costly war. And then they say, the book is also an apology for bestowing legitimacy on a group of men incapable of ruling Iraq. Is that what it is? Is it an apology?
It is an apology not for the war. It is an apology for having played a role, which I admit I did, in bestowing, conferring some kind of legitimacy upon what was called in the old days the Iraqi opposition, and most of whose members today occupy major seats of power, and they were empowered and put in place by the American war. So in that sense, I deeply regret that. I apologize for it specifically and explicitly, especially in the Arabic edition, where I have a much longer apology.
So who specifically are you apologizing to?
People of Iraq, the Shiite community into which I was born, and all those Iraqis who used to follow my writings and my various and sundry appearances over the years. And that's important because I am not saying, if I may be absolutely clear, that I would do anything other than support a war to overthrow that particular dictatorship, namely the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. To be honest with you, Meghna, I wouldn't know how to do anything else. The be-all and end-all of my life was certainly not to promote a war, but it was to write about dictatorship. I mean, nearly a third of my life has been spent doing that. And I became so convinced of the criminality of that particular regime, I was utterly convinced, and still am today, that its removal by any means necessary, I might add, was a moral thing to do. Think of a Syrian person today whose family are sitting in Aleppo with barrel bombs being dropped on their heads by the regime of Bashar al-Assad, and you will understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah, but I mean, speaking of Syria, though, I mean, many analysts would say that the quagmire of Syria and the ongoing nature of it is directly related to the catastrophe in Iraq.
I don't agree. The state of Arab affairs, if I might say so, the very fact that Syria fell apart, that Libya is falling apart, that Yemen, one country after another, is falling apart, indicates that what went wrong is not the caused by the 2003
war. Well, let me clarify then. The international community's either response or lack of response, depending on your point of view, that's
yes.
What people point to Iraq as being a major influencing factor.
I realize that, but I think that's an immoral and indefensible position when hundreds of thousands of people are being killed in a matter of a very short period of time and when absolutely no future and no end to this seemingly intractable conflict appears before our eyes. So the question is what it is that one is pushing for. The issue of Syria is not just ISIS. ISIS is slowly being shrunk down on all sides, and I think ISIS will, in a period of time, disappear. But the problem is what will replace ISIS? And here we get to the real roots of what went wrong in Iraq. Mm-hmm. That is the failure of the Arab state system, if I might put it that way. We're witnessing a failure that's decades in the making, not just the 12 or 13 years since 2003. And we need to understand it as such in order to even think about where we go from here.
Well, so you have written before that Iraqi mistakes are orders of magnitude more important to understand what went wrong in Iraq than American mistakes.
I absolutely true, and I think that's the reason I wrote the book the way I did. If you notice, although it tells a story between 2003 and 2006, it tells an Iraqi story. And it truly is an all-Iraqi story. Deliberately, the Americans are there in the background, the helicopters hovering up and scene descriptions here and there. They make the odd decision here and there, which influence some of the characters in the novel. But all the actors are American, are Iraqi, and that is how it should be. And the point underlying that is that when you look at what really went wrong in 2003, it's not that the Americans didn't do 101 things wrong, of course. Massive mistakes that have been very well written about by others. Tons of excellent books exist on the errors that the Americans made. But the principal errors for why we are in the state we are today in a country like Iraq were made by Iraqi actors, empowered, to be sure, by the American war, but nonetheless actors who had made choices that were the wrong choices, in my opinion. Other choices could have been made that have brought the country to its knees in the way that they have. And that's what my book is about.
You center the book around two deaths.
Correct.
One of them is the manner in which Saddam Hussein himself was executed. And why do that?
Well, that was such a revealing moment. The ugliness with which he was essentially hanged. It wasn't really a hanging. It was a lynching more than anything else. And so I set the scene for what had become, so to speak, of Iraqi politics by 2006, 3 years after the war. Just about when the civil war inside Baghdad was getting underway, with that experience. And it's partly because I myself was physically sick after I learned the full details on the very day it happened, and the little video clip that was circulated over the internet was shown. I couldn't get out of bed for a couple of days. I was so disgusted. I was so absolutely revolted. So that makes an appearance. And incidentally, that part of the book is as part one of the book is as factual as I knew how to make it to be. I mean, I imagine his feelings. I imagine certain things, I suppose. But I didn't at all budge from an attempt to be as factual as I possibly could. That's not true of the third part, where Saddam appears as a character who talks and thinks, etc. But so it begins with that. And the second death that you referred to is in some ways even more important. It happens on the day of the fall of the regime. It happens in the holiest city of Shiism, Najaf, the city of Najaf. It happens in the holiest site of the holiest city, that is in the mosque of the shrine of Ali ibn Abi Talib, the patron saint of Shiism, you could say. And it is perpetrated by the son of one essentially grand Ayatollah against the son of another Grand Ayatollah, the previous Grand Ayatollah, who died in 1992. So the symbolism of it, the first had stayed in Iraq that whole period. He was the second, namely the one who had come in from the outside. He supported the war, and he returned to Iraq 10 or 12 days before, returned to Najaf in particular, to try to, I suppose, convince the clerical class, especially Ayatollah Sistani, the Grand Ayatollah at the moment, and the Grand Ayatollah back then in 2003, that at least to either support the overthrow of the regime or at least not oppose it. So that murder, you know, is a symbolic level, remarkable, and very significant. And it symbolizes what went wrong, and that's why I use it, with the Shia political class.
So let me ask you, the book has been reviewed and you yourself say that your novel is an indictment of the Iraqi ruling elite and its failures after the 2003 war invasion. But I have to ask you, there was ample evidence before the U.S. invasion that such an outcome might come to pass? I mean, I was looking at a 2002 Boston Globe article where you yourself said that you think there's less than a 5% chance that what I'd like to see happens actually happens. But it seems to be an obligation, the invasion, even if it's only a 5% chance to make it happen. And then, you know, I was looking at, for example, George Packer, writer for The New Yorker, who you know very well, who in 2003, just 17 days before the invasion began, said that the closer we get to war, the harder it is to believe that the liberal democracy Kanan Makiya envisions will ever be the outcome. People had misgivings about the capacity of the ruling elite to govern before we even began shock and awe.
They had doubts about its ability to deliver a democracy, a liberal democracy.
But that was what was being sold to the American people to justify the war.
That's what George Bush sold the American public to, weapons of mass destruction, actually was the main sort of bill of sale. I never bought into that. I never thought weapons of mass destruction, whether he had them or not, was the main issue. Mind you, I thought he had them. In that, I was wrong, as so many people were. But I didn't think that was the reason to go to war. The issue for me, the be-all and end-all of my life, has been the issue of dictatorship. That dictatorship, and this is an extreme form of dictatorship. It's probably the Arab world's most extreme dictator. That for me was non-negotiable. The dictator had to go. Now, I thought there was a slim chance, and I thought it was the obligation of people like me to make that transition into the 5%, 10% that you mentioned, namely towards democracy.
So let me ask you, because again, I don't, as you said earlier, whether or not to go to war is a separate question, but studying why the aftermath happened and in the way that it did is of profound interest, because, you know, it was what, your 1993 book, Cruelty and Silence? I mean, you were already expressing very reasoned and passionate doubts about the Arab intelligentsia.
True.
But it was you know, a faction of that same intelligentsia that was told to go and take Iraq into an Arab democracy.
But I felt, and I still think it's true, as an activist. Now, I wear two hats, I mean, like all of us do in life. On the one hand, the professional hat, I'm a writer. I do my best to tell the things as I see them. On the other hand, I was an activist for the removal of that particular dictator, Saddam Hussein. And in my activist hat, I know the world and options are full of choices. People, men, and they were, alas, mostly men who came to power in the post-2003, make choices, and they need not have made those choices. They could have made other choices. Now, you may say there's a slim chance that they would make the right choices, as I did, and as you quoted me, but it's still my obligation. I think it's even a moral obligation to press for the successful coming to being of those choices, however slim the chance may be. Think of the American Revolution. What were the chances of defeating the British and establishing the kind of constitution, the kind of republic that the United States became? Slim at the very outset. But men took the chance. They opted, so to speak, on the basis of on the basis of what was the least likely thing to happen. And I think that was the right thing to do.
Well, more than 4,500 Americans have died. More than 165,000 Iraqis have been killed since 2003. I mean,
I'm not.
What does the 5% chance mean to the survivors of those killed?
The 5% is what I would work towards. And my chances of, it's not the reason for going to war. The overthrow of the dictator, the beginning of a new life. Remember what Iraq was like on the eve of 2003. Under sanctions that had utterly decapitated the middle class. Sanctions that had probably done more to damage the country than either the 2003 war or the 1990 war, one war that preceded. Iraq was in an impossible situation. If with that particular dictator in power, no hope for the future existed. So the beginning of hope, and hope is a complicated and difficult thing, the beginning of hope, I gambled on hope, and I think that was the right thing to do. I mean, think of the title of President Obama's book.
The Audacity of Hope,
that's exactly. I dared to bet on hope, and I would do it again. but I was wrong on certain things that I should also, in all honesty, be frank about and admit, as we are talking now.
You know, in the book, I get the sense that, you very directly ask about, you question yourself about where you went wrong in your thinking. I wonder if writing this novel, is it Kanan Mekia sort of grappling with it sounds like maybe not, because you just said that you still dare to hope, but I wonder, does that genuinely continue to be true?
I have demons inside me like everybody else, I'm sure, and perhaps I am doing that. But the novel is also, one writes a book for others, and one in the back of one's mind how they react. And it is surely not a coincidence that it is a runaway bestseller after only 4 weeks in the Arabic edition in Baghdad. Now that's interesting. And that's important. And my heart, it's full of joy because of that. People are reading it. People are discussing it. Oh, all kinds of things are being said. Nasty things about me, nice things about me. That's not the issue. The point is, it seemed to touch a chord in very large numbers of people who today, as it so happens, are exactly looking at what went wrong the way I looked at it, but perhaps coming to different conclusions. That's what's on everybody's mind in Iraq, inside Iraq today. So simply to have opened up that discussion, what went wrong, simply as a Shiite to say that the agenda that these people worked towards was a sectarian agenda, and to point out how the very idea of Iraq has essentially been dismantled, not by the Americans, but by the Iraqi elite that today numbers several thousands of people, 5,000-10,000 people, add all the people in parliaments, the advisors, etc., and the ministers coming and going all the time. And you have a class of people today that are consistently behaving in a way that undermines the chances of a future.
Kanan Mekia, there's one last thing I want to ask you. The reason why you wrote this book and the things you're thinking matters because you did have a front row seat to the decision-making process in the run-up to the Iraq War, and that you did have connections with the people making the decisions about what would happen after. And so it just got me thinking. Dexter Filkins in 2007 of the New York Times, he wrote this about you. He says, it seems Mekia's heart, his passion to destroy Hussein, his passion to bring freedom to Iraq, does not want him to go where his intellect would take him. And he describes you as a man of very high intellect. He says, where would it go? What would it say? Possibly something like this. You exposed a terrible dictatorship, and for the noblest of motives, you signed on to an invasion that ended in catastrophe. You misjudged your native country and your adopted one, too. In the last minute that we have, is that what your novel is saying?
I didn't misjudge large numbers of people. I misjudged the leaders who came to power in the immediate post-2003 time. I knew those men. I worked with those men. But in the end of the day, I was not a member of any particular party or organization. I was a writer. And while people may have listened or may have read my pieces, nobody went to war. The United States certainly did not go to war because Kanan Mekia asked it to. So, one should be humble as to one's ability to influence such things. The United States is a great big power. It does what it does for its own reasons. I made my voice clear. Dictatorship, the be-all and end-all of my life, the struggle against dictatorship, that was for me important, still is important, not just in Iraq but in Syria, and I still stand by that.
Well, Kanan Mekia is the Sylvia Hassenfeld Professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University. His new book, a novel, is The Rope. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.